On today's episode of The Good Word, we discuss the eligibility rules that Joel Embiid and Tyrese Halliburton are running up against. NBA scoring is up, a little too much up, and we're trying to fix it. And we tell you which games to watch this week. All that and producer John on this episode of The Good Word.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports and the host of this podcast. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. Since it is Wednesday, it is a solo show. It is myself and producer John. We are going a little early here on Wednesday morning, so y'all going to get this. Y'all going to get this bright and early Wednesday afternoon. Trust me, because it is almost damn near pitch black here, but we doing this for y'all. So last night, John, we had a completely different rundown. We were going to go in a completely different direction, but, you know, there was some sound that came out of Madison Square Garden that was really, really interesting. And it wasn't from Tom Thibodeau, wasn't from Julius Randle, wasn't from nobody like that. It was from MSG's and ESPN ABC's announcer, the voice of the NBA Finals, Mike Breen, going in on Colin Sexton.
Sexton's playing some mind games right now, getting in Jalen Brunson's face, chatting with him. Brett Barnicke just warned him to stop the taunting.
Sexton averages 17 a game.
Now he's talking to the fans. A lot of talk after a 1-for-10 game last night.
All right, John. So now that you've heard that, did you even think that Mike Breen could go there?
Yes. I feel like Mike Breen doesn't hold back from roasting people from time to time. It's part of the reason we like him. It's part of his charm.
Mike Breen went like 2012 Twitter on somebody last night. I won't say he went Vinny Twitter on somebody, because that I'm a little more acid in the voice on that one. But he went pretty hard. When Mike Breen goes in on you, I don't care what the allegiances are, you got to feel really bad, right? If you're Colin Sexton and you hear that, how do you feel when you're in the locker room? Because you can't go in. You can't go. Like, remember, I don't know if you remember this story. DeMarcus Cousins heard about Sean Elliott. This is when DeMarcus Cousins was in Sacramento in the full Kings experience. And Sean Elliott, who was a former Spurs player who became a Spurs announcer, was going in on Boogie during a game. I think the game was in Sacramento. And Boogie went looking for that man after the game. He went looking for that man. If you're Colin Sexton, you can't go looking for Mike Breen. What you gonna do when you run home Mike Breen? I heard you was talking about me. Was I? Like if Mike Breen said, I wasn't talking about you. I just said you went, you know. Just said you ain't shoot well last night. Really? That's all you said? Yeah. Oh, okay. My bad. That's how that would go.
To be fair, Boogie tended to look for that fight whenever he could. And I think even Boogie would understand there's no point in grabbing Mike Breen being like, let's go outside, because I don't think Mike Breen's going to swing at Boogie Cousins. I don't think he would swing at Colin Sexton. Boogie might go say something to him. But the reason Boogie wanted to meet Sean Elliott in the parking lot is because Sean Elliott was a former player, and Boogie's like, "Hey, you're one of us. You gotta face the fire."
Oh no, I don't think Boogie had that level of discernment. I think Boogie was just going after whoever. Boogie was going to boogie on whomever said anything about him. Okay, you go find that man. That's what that was going to be. You go find that man. That's a line from a movie. Y'all go figure out which movie it is. But you go find that man. That's what type of time that Boogie would have been on. And Colin Sexton couldn't be on that kind of time. And the Knicks, unshockingly, whipped up on the Utah Jazz last night. We had Fred Katz on Monday. Go back and listen to that show. We gave the New York Knicks all the praise. And I believe they're 14-2 or 13-2 this month. They've climbed into third in the Eastern Conference. They have slipped past the Philadelphia 76ers, who lost last night in San Francisco to Golden State. And if you were like me, you stayed up really late to watch the end of that game, or tried to watch the end of that game, You saw Joel Embiid limping around in that loss. And John, he initially hurt himself against the Pacers, was a last second scratch on Saturday night against Denver, which had all of Twitter going full Twitter, saying, oh, you're ducking Jokic, because it was such a last second thing. He was not listed on the injury report. He then missed Monday's game against Portland. This was the second game of a back-to-back, a road back-to-back. He played, and you could see him limping around. He had an early collision. But Joel Embiid always tends to look like if there was a basketball version of Fred Sanford, it would be Joel Embiid running around or limping around. He always looks like he is 5 seconds away from grabbing his heart and saying, Elizabeth, I'm coming back home to you. That's what he looks like whenever he's playing ball. And you look at the stat sheet at the end of the night. Oh, and he's got 50. So I won't say that was an unusual occurrence. I will say it looked like that man was laboring last night. And now Joel Embiid, because of the games that he's missed and perhaps the conversation that has swirled around him, now he went out there and played last night. I don't think he wanted to miss another national TV game, especially with our friend Stan Van Gundy on the call, because Stan would bring out the machete on Joel Embiid if Joel Embiid did not play last night. He played, and unfortunately for us, we would have had to see him play for him to get benefit of the doubt. Embiid doesn't have the benefit of the doubt from us as a whole, not necessarily like me or you, John, but it doesn't seem like Joel Embiid has benefit of the doubt from the public when it comes to these things, even though, you know, he plays in national TV games. He didn't play on Christmas. He didn't play against Denver, but usually he plays, John.
Usually. I mean, I was just looking at his basketball reference, and how many games do you think he played last year? Do you know?
I do know. I believe he played 66 games last year.
Yep. And the year before that, he played 68 games, which is the most regular season games he's ever played in a season. Outside of once he got past the really early career injury issues, he's basically been somewhere in the 50s or 60s in terms of games played every season. And right now he's sitting at 34, about halfway through the season. So along that same trend line of, you know, being a 65, 66, 67 game player again, which is what he was last year when he was the MVP.
Yeah, it's a very weird thing when you're talking about these new mechanisms which have been legislated as part of the new collective bargaining agreement. I have different feelings for Joel Embiid than I do for Tyrese Halliburton. Completely different feeling. Like Nick Nurse last night, he said, hey, this knee is completely unrelated to the other knee issues that Joel Embiid has had. And when you're a massive man that moves the way that Joel Embiid moves, that has the dexterity, the athleticism, and he's not overweight. I don't think he's overweight. I think he used to be when he was battling, getting on the floor, you know, those first couple of years. But I don't think that's necessarily a function of too much weight on his knees. I don't think he's always been in shape, but I don't think that's necessarily the case now. But you're always going to be concerned about his knees and his back and how healthy he's going to be. On the other side, we have Tyrese Halliburton, who's in the first game of the TNT doubleheader, Pacers-Celtics. He made his return after missing 13 games with his hamstring injury. In the game in which he left, he played 13 minutes. Why is that important? That's important because as negotiated into the CBA, players must play in at least 20 minutes in a given game for that game to be counted towards the 65 games to be eligible for postseason awards. I think that we can have some wiggle room on that because in a game in which you slip and you get yourself hurt, you're not load managing. You're not skirting anything. You get hurt. And when you get hurt and you're playing, if you play 13 minutes, it's not 13 minutes and it's a minute left in the fourth quarter. Like Tyrese Halliburton is a high minute, high production, high usage guy. He slipped on a piece of floor and he wound up missing 13 games. I think the league should give us some wiggle room on that. Give the players some wiggle room. Give the media some wiggle room. But, John, this is where things get tricky, right? Because Tyrese Halliburton, this offseason, he can sign for $245 million if he makes an All-NBA roster in the last year of his rookie deal. The base would be $204. So that's a $40 million difference. Assuming he, you know, doesn't miss any games the rest of the way, he can get that $245. But now he's in this wiggle room. He's in this space where he doesn't have much wiggle room to miss games anymore. And, of course, Tyrese Halliburton on his rookie deal says the rule is stupid. But the problem is, John, the rule was negotiated by Tamika Tramaglio in the National Basketball Players Association. Who's Tamika Tramaglio, you ask? She is the outgoing executive director. She replaced Michelle Roberts, who held the post for, I want to say, almost 10 years, or maybe even longer than 10 years, when Michelle replaced Billy Hunter. But she's outgoing, and she was barely on the job for 9 months. She negotiated the CBA. Some things went haywire behind the scenes. You would have people say that the job was not too enormous for her, but not enormous enough. Does that make sense, John?
I mean, what do you mean by not enormous enough? The job being too much for her makes sense. The not enormous enough is confusing.
Well, the enormity of the job, I don't think, really was the problem. I think the lack of visibility, some would say, was the problem.
For her. Problem for her.
For her.
Got it. Okay.
For her. That's what you hear from people behind the scenes. Andre Iguodala has replaced her, and we haven't heard much on a new search for an executive director. And this was something that I'd heard from owners after they first met her. And I think this is a larger issue, and we can wind up getting into it one day. But this is something that I heard from a couple of owners when they first met her. I said, hey, what are your initial impressions? Because there's only so much that we knew about Tamika Tramaglio. And this is what an owner said to me. I went to another owner and he said, that's a perfect analogy. John, they said, the first one said, oh, I like Tamika a lot. And usually you don't hear that. So I go into, you know, why. And he says, Tamika wants the public wins. We'll get the wins that matter. And I went to another owner and I said, hey, this is what one of your fellow 30 said. And he said, that's a great way to put it.
So she wasn't necessarily fighting on behalf of what was best for the players. And I think you're drawing a straight line from that to the fact that Tyrese Halliburton slipped on the floor and is now on the verge of losing $40 million.
I'm saying you can look at certain parts of the CBA and wonder where the players actually got their real wins. You can look at the CBA and say, oh, the players can have, you know, equity and stakes into teams. And then you realize that that's really not the case. But it sounds nice. It sounds nice on its face. It's a great headline. But when you go and read in between the lines, it's not so much. But I don't know if even Tamika Tramaglio, John, could have truly stopped all of this. I don't know if anybody could have stopped all this, because the public's lack of faith in players in the age of load management had gotten so low. Like there's a phrase that a friend of mine, who I used to hang around because she was close to someone I dated. And her philosophy on men was this. She would say, Vinny, the bar is low. Okay, I'm like, okay, the bar is low. What does that mean? And I would like put my hand down, 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 down. And she would say, no. And I'm like, where's the bar? She said, the bar is the floor. That is where the public's confidence in players were leading up to this CBA. You can blame Kawhi Leonard. You can really blame Greg Popovich for sending the San Antonio Spurs in 2014 on a Southwest flight out of Miami. And that's what started all of this. Go look it up. That's what started this entire load management thing. And then it's completely gone awry. And then when you have players who have legitimate injuries, they no longer get the benefit of the doubt because of the sins of the other players who took advantage, or the sins of the other teams who took advantage. Not just the players, teams. Players don't often make these decisions. It's players, it's agents, it's front offices, it's medical staffs. Players are going to take the hit from it. And then players are going to take the financial hit from it. And then the teams actually, John, the teams are going to benefit. Because you know what happens when Tyrese Halliburton doesn't make $245 million? You know what happens there? The Indiana Pacers put that money back in their pockets. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So it's a weird thing. And Joel Embiid, like, when I look at the numbers, Joel Embiid has the fewest games, and we just talked about the fewest games played for an MVP since MVP has become to be voted on by the media. The media didn't vote for most valuable player until 1980. So the Kareem Early MVPs, the Russell MVPs, all of those, the random Dave Collins MVPs, the Bill Walton 58 games MVP in 1978, I believe. Those were all voted on by the players. The media did not take over until 1980. So the five MVP low number seasons. John, do you want to guess the five low number MVP seasons, or do you want me to just tell you?
You should probably just tell me, because it would take me a while, I think, to guess. But this is where I would point out, like, it's not going to be a LeBron season. It's not going to be a Michael Jordan season. Like, part of the reason those guys gets to be in the greatest of all time conversations is they didn't have any of these years where they're like, I'm going to play like 60 games because I want to save my body for the playoffs. And even like Kobe didn't really do that. So I'm interested to see who's on this list.
All right. So here's my criteria. The criteria is an 82-game season, so not a lockout-shortened season, or a COVID-shortened season, or a, whoa, what is this new COVID thing? So that's like 2019-20, yeah, 72 games in, and then 72 games in the next season in 2021. So you take those out. You take out the lockout-shortened seasons. So Joel Embiid, 66 games, as we mentioned earlier, the fewest games allowed, fewest games played, for an MVP. That was last year. In 2018, James Harden. Yeah. James Harden, 72 games. In 2019, Giannis Antetokounmpo, his first MVP season, 72 games. In 2022, the first full season back from COVID, Nikola Jokic, 74 games. And the one outlier that makes all the damn sense in the world, Allen Iverson in 2001 played 71 games. Why? Because Allen Iverson's whole body was beat up, right? Like, I don't know if you remember NBC, because they had the rights then. They used to have like this game of operation almost, where they would have Allen Iverson's body parts like listed, like they had him, like his body extended, like on a visual, like he was going up for a dunk. So you could see his entire, you know, 6'1" frame on the screen. It would say, it was like knee, ankle, hip, finger, neck, you know, like all these things were highlighted because that's how hard he played and how small he was and how physical the game was. And there's a level of understanding, even if Allen Iverson played today, if he played like that, and the game was physical, I don't think anybody would crow and say, ah, AI, you missed 11 games. They'd look at him and say, you're 6 feet tall, 170 pounds on a good day. We understand. It's hard for people to understand now because of everything that's happened in the past. It's hard for people to understand. Now, it's going to be hard for people to get Tyrese Halliburton. People are going to rally behind that one and say, that's unfair to that guy. I don't know if people are going to rally behind Joel Embiid. And secondarily, John, Philly's in fourth in the Eastern Conference. And they're right tied, if I believe, with the Cleveland Cavaliers for fifth, mind you. And I don't know if you know my baseline for voting for MVP, but one of my baselines is, John, your team's got to win 50 games. How much of an impact on winning can you have if your team has only won 50 games? And in a modern NBA, and by modern, I mean playoff expansion, post-playoff expansion to 16 teams in four rounds. That means 1984. But even if we stretch it back to the voting of the media, the fewest games won for an MVP was Michael Jordan in 1988. His Bulls won 50 games. Why is Michael Jordan so different? Why, you know, why isn't the bar higher? You want to know why the bar is higher? Isn't higher for him? Because he won Defensive Player of the Year that year too, which meant he was the most dominant damn player on both ends of the floor while averaging 35 a night. That's why. Yeah, exceptions are made for the exceptional. Get over it, right? That's what it is. But John has created a list of players who are trending towards ineligibility. I'm going to let John read these names off to you because I want you to take a moment to pause and listen to the names of players who may not be on the postseason ballots. And it won't be the big bad media's fault.
And these aren't, like, I could have gotten more creative and put on the guys who have missed 7, 8, 9 games this year. Mm-hmm. I could have put on Bradley Beal. I could have put on Ja Morant. I could have put on Kevin Durant, who's missed like 7 or 8 games. These are just the guys that I'm pretty sure are not going to be eligible by the end of the season. So number one is Kyrie Irving, already ineligible. He's already mm-hmm. missed too many games. Kyrie's mm-hmm. not going to make all NBA. He's not going to get votes for MVP. Not that he was probably going to anyway. Most improved player, any of those things. Kyrie's out. Joel, who we talked about. Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo.
Mm-hmm.
Tyrese Halliburton, who we discussed. Kristaps Porzingis, that's an important one. And then Donovan Mitchell, who seems healthier now. He's playing out of his mind now, but he's over the like halfway point. We're about halfway through the season, so I included him. I just want to very quickly kind of tie some of these strings together that we've been talking about for months now. Because we've talked about the young guns are coming for the vets as far mm-hmm. as like NBA superstars, hierarchy, all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was just glancing at the standings and I'm like, okay, well, Jimmy and Bam have missed some time. Miami's in the play-in. They're mm-hmm. seventh in the East. Mm-hmm. Boston is at the top. They've mostly been healthy. Milwaukee's at the top. They've been healthy. New York's at the top. They've been healthy. Cleveland's been pretty healthy. Like, Philadelphia's been great, but Joel missing all this time, like you said, has dropped them down to fifth in the East. The Pacers were really hot. They're all the way down to sixth in the East. You look at teams like Dallas, who, like I said, Kyrie's missed enough time that he's already ineligible for year-end awards. They're in the play-in. New Orleans missed all that time with CJ McCollum. They're in the play-in. The Lakers, you know, LeBron and AD have mostly been healthy and playing, but everyone else has had fits and starts as far as getting healthy. They're in the play-in. Phoenix is sixth. But you look at the teams at the top. Minnesota, they've been young, they've been healthy. Denver, I think we can still throw them, even though they're champs, we can still throw them in the category of young and healthy. Oklahoma City, young and healthy. The Clippers have somehow figured out how to stay healthy without doing the load management thing. It's a miracle. Golden State.
In a contract year.
Golden State, not even in the play-in. Memphis, not even in the play-in. Like, in the way that the NBA wanted this to work, it's working. Because the young players are able to play more than the older players, and that's giving them an advantage, and that's leading to more wins, and that's leading to them kind of taking over that mantle from the older veteran superstars as far as playoff appearances and seeding and all that, probably faster than it would have otherwise happened. So I think the NBA is probably real happy about this, even though the players and the fans are probably not.
I don't know if the league is happy or unhappy about that. I think that will show when the public gets to know Anthony Edwards, when the public gets to know Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and the public won't get to know these players to tune into their regular season games until they have playoff bona fides, until you have playoff skins on the wall. And maybe this is the year where Oklahoma City has the playoff skin on the wall. Minnesota is sneakily not really young, but Anthony Edwards is young. So there's like a fine line to walk there. And the Clippers operate in this weird space where we had Dan Wierke on last week, and Dan said the Clippers matter more outside of L.A. than inside of L.A. It'll be very curious to see how the Clippers rate in a playoff series if all of their players are there, and how much we, not just the basketball public or the basketball lifers, so to speak, but the general public who tunes into the playoffs, how much they tune in to the LA Clippers. Are they still viewed as the clown franchise? So that being said, John, we have other pressing issues to discuss here. Scoring is up, way up, two up, if you ask me, across the league. The average score every night, teams are putting up 115 points a game. Averaging 35 three-pointers a night. Shots are not really up year over year. Like, I went and looked at the numbers on Basketball Reference. Like, 115 used to be a special night. You were really cooking if you scored 115 a night. And that was in the days of not necessarily like the slowdown, you know, 90s, where teams were barely getting up 90, or the early 2000s. I mean, even when you get to the early days of 7 seconds or less, like when four guys score 60 plus in a week, and we compare it to Kobe Bryant scoring 81. When Kobe scored 81, John, the average team scored 97 a night. That's what made it so special. Because we weren't so reliant on a three-point shot, and we knew that we were watching a dude completely explode. Now that you got four guys scoring 60 in a night or two nights in a row or whatever it was, two nights, right? You got to start looking at how the sausage is made. And scoring being up does not equal a better game, in my opinion. I don't think we need to go back to the Stone Age, but I was talking to executives, I was talking to coaches last night, and John, they all agree that changes need to be made to aid and help the defense. And there's been, you know, different iterations of the NBA, like even as far as the two big changes that have happened over the past, there hasn't been two huge stylistic changes to the floor. But the last two changes to the floor was the restricted area. That came in the 97-98 season. So that became a point where, okay, you can't plant yourself under the rim and take a charge. Like, you have to be in a reasonable distance. I think that was a really great, great addition. And a couple seasons before that, because scoring was down so much, they moved the three-point line in from 23-9, I believe it was like, to 22-6. They moved it in, and it was an explosion from three-point shooting for two seasons, and then they moved it right back to 23-9. That's my inner geek popping up, because that's not even in the show notes. So, but I am of the belief, John, that changes must be made because scoring is out of control. The skill sets are great. Like, you can see Joel Embiid, you can see all these guys. The skill sets are excellent, but I have a, I won't say a problem. I would say that when Luka Doncic comes out and says, oh yeah, it's much easier to score here than international, or the game is much more physical in the international game than anywhere than the NBA game, that's where the plot has gotten lost. That's where the NBA has to look at itself and ask, what are we doing here? That's where the NBA, John, has to look at itself and say, well, maybe the metrics say that fans like this. But as far as looking to the future, you can't have every team scoring 120 points. You can't have, John, 48 dudes score 20 points a night. 48. What does 20 points a night mean anymore? That used to be a benchmark for, say, oh man, you were not good. because you could be a terrible defensive player. But that meant something. That was a benchmark. That was a mark of you were a player of note. If 50 guys do it, what does that mean?
Yeah, it used to be 20 and 10 a night gets you an all-star appearance. Now there's dudes who get 20-10 a night, and even their own fan base is like, yeah, this guy isn't really, we need to replace him, get someone better in here, more dynamic.
Your fans don't even respect you. You know, your fans don't even like you. I get 20-10. And? So, John, I'm going to let you go first because we all have proposals on how to, quote unquote, fix the game. The game isn't broken. I'm going to say that. The game is not broken. The skill sets are great. The three-point shooting is up. It's more three-point attempts, like three being worth more than two. I won't say the geeks have gotten involved in it, but that has been a huge reason why we see, you know, more blowouts or teams that can't put teams away because you fall in love with a three-point shot or a team can get hot from three and a 20-point lead is no longer a 20-point lead anymore. So, John, what is your number one thing, your number one or two things that you would say, okay, these are things that need to be tightened up or completely changed?
This is my number one thing, and I decided to get a little crazy with it.
With it, just
crazy enough that it would really shake things up, right?
Can we get the Batman, the Bruce Wayne, Let's Get Nuts drop in?
I can certainly try. if you hear it here, it's because I was able to find it and pull it off. If you don't, I wasn't. I'm sorry. I did a fair amount of research on this, and I saw a lot of people saying, like, the refs just need to enforce the game, right? The carries are getting out of control again. Sure, I get that. Moving screens are getting out of control. Sure, I get that. I saw a lot of people talking about offensive players putting their head down and bullying their way into a lane and then expecting a foul call, basically flopping to try and get free throws. Yeah, sure. The referee should do a better job of calling the game the way it's meant to be called, but also those rules are in place and the refs aren't doing that. So whatever. I like this one. And I appreciate that you knew the distances of the line and the line moving, because the NBA 3-point shot, which again is worth one more point than inside the line, is a different distance from different parts of the court.
Mm.
If you were in the corners, that is a 22-foot shot. If you are above the break, that's at least a 23.9 inches shot. It's basically a 24-foot shot. It's 2 feet further away, and therefore it's more difficult. The easiest, most valuable shot in the entire court is the corner three. And I've seen a bunch of people draw up a new three-point line that just does not extend all the way down to the corner. And it's like, screw it. We're getting rid of corner threes. Because you know what it feels like when you watch NBA now? And it never really felt like this before to me, but it does now. You know when you play pickup and it's you're playing ones and twos?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you go and play in like a real game for something. And all those shots that were worth one are now worth two. And all the shots that were worth two are now worth three. And you watch the numbers go flying up. And you're like, damn, I scored like 15 points today. How the hell did I score 15 points? Because in your head, 15 mm-hmm. points is insane. Because yes. normally you got to get there with ones and twos. But you could just catch a heater. You make three or four threes in a game. And all of a sudden, you're looking at 15 points. And that's what it feels like. It feels like they're playing a different game in terms of the scoring. And the corner three, I think, is like half the problem. I think if you got rid of the corner three, it would really fix a lot of things.
I got a text from a GM yesterday. I was texting coaches and execs, and I was texting the league office too, and they clearly are not ready to go into radical changes territory, right? They think I'm a little bit on the militant side, which I probably am. But GM I texted yesterday, he said, I said, you know, any rule changes you would make to help defenses? And he said, not much rule changes, but adjustments for more appropriate physicality for the defensive players. The offensive player gets touch fouls, but also gets away with push-offs. And you see that. You will see a player use the arm bar, which you cannot use anymore really to defend. But if you're an offensive player, you can use that arm bar. As long as you don't fully extend, you can use it to protect yourself, so to speak. And then you'll see people sort of do more than protect themselves. You'll see them send players flying. I have a radical one. My radical one is to allow hand checking on the perimeter. John is shaking his head. John is losing his mind over there.
About this one. I don't like it. I don't like it. But continue.
Here's the reason why I like it, or why I'm willing to entertain it, is because there's so much switching and hunting on the perimeter. What happens is teams will take their best player, have them at the top of the key, and they will screen and screen and screen and move the worst defender into the action, or some level of mismatch where you have a small on a big or a big on a small, and you have that switching because you're not allowed to hold the player up to give the extra defender time to recover from the screen, right? So if you're allowing me to hand check, like if you're on YouTube, like you can see, like if you allow a player to hand check, that gives them time to recover to get back in front. That's not a pick and roll hand check. That's just the hunting of a weaker defender. If you're in motion, then it doesn't matter as much to me. Now, I'm sure there's mechanisms or unintended consequences that come with that, but I think that is something that we can see, because before you would get switches, and a former player brought this up, and this is a big man, so he was quite funny about it. He said, you know, back in the day, when I would get a switch on a player and I would have a smaller player on me, I'd put my big paw up and they would throw the ball down to me and I would go to work, draw a double team kick or go out and, you know, whatever. He said, now you get a switch. If I get a switch of a smaller player on me, I'm getting cleared out. Because the guard wants to go to work, whether that becomes a step back three, a drive to the basket, so he needs the space. That's what the game has become. And the game has become almost homogenized in a way that everybody's hunting the corner three. Everybody's hunting these mismatches to go and maximize the quote-unquote shot profile. We can't take these long twos. The numbers say we can't take the long twos, so we can't do that anymore. And people often reminisce, sometimes a little too nostalgically, if that's even a word that I can use, nostalgically. I had to look that up. But they reminisce in such a nostalgic way because of the diversity of offenses. You had some teams do the run and gun. You had some teams like the Bulls, they played triangle. Could the triangle work in today's game? Michael Jordan was the greatest mid-range shooter towards the end of his career in the NBA. He could hit everything from 18 and in and 21 and in. Like you make him a three-point shooter, you might have more success there, but the triangle kept him on the move and he could operate in those middle thirds and he could still get to the basket when he needed to, but he operated from 16 to 22 feet. And was still graceful and it was still entertaining and all that. But the numbers say we can't take those shots anymore. We can't have a high diet of those shots anymore. I don't mind that. If that's your range, that's your range. Like take the shots you can make. Maybe we'll talk about this in the Love Doctor episodes. Hey man, take shots you can make, dog. I got friends, John, you know this? I got a friend, and he's been on the show before, but I won't tell you who it is. I got a friend who told me, you know, Vinny, your philosophy, he says, you know, I would have a good, really good batting average as far as how he, you know, how he used to approach, you know, people of the opposite persuasion. He said to me, he was like, you go for free throws. You want to have a higher percentage. He said, look, man, if I bat 300, that means I'm a Hall of Famer. I'm like, yeah, that's true. Hey, but you got 7 strikeouts, too. I don't know about these strikeouts, right? So, but the point is, take shots you can make. Not everybody doesn't have to be a three-point shooter. And because of all that, there's a certain type of player that can't play in the NBA anymore, and I don't like that. Charles Oakley, I literally brought this name up to a coach last night. Charles Oakley could not play in today's NBA. He was a decent spot-up shooter from 17 feet off the double team, but he wanted a three-point shooter. Rough, rugged, probably a little too rough, a little too rugged. But you mean to tell me there's no place in the NBA for that type of player anymore? That's, I don't know if that's an NBA I want to consistently watch. Am I tripping, John?
No, and I think we're barking up the same tree, and I'll explain to you why I didn't
like
go...
eliminating corner threes. Eliminating the corner threes.
Well, and I think this solves a lot of these issues, right? Because when I think back to the form of basketball that I grew up with, yes, I am one of those people who's like, I like the diversity of different types of offenses. And part of what does that is just having different parts of the floor be activated. And when we were growing up, maybe the most important part of the floor in a half-court offense was the post. And I'm not just saying like, oh, big guys near the basket. I'm literally talking side basket to the corner three spot. And in your head, if I say these names, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. But Hakeem used that area in a very different way than Patrick Ewing used that area, in a very different way than Shaquille O'Neal used that area. And then there were teams that didn't have the big man who could do anything in the post, and they had to figure out other ways to score points. Now, I think what happened was everyone's like, we don't need Patrick Ewing and hell, Dirk Nowitzki shooting 16, 17, 18 foot shots right there when they can back up 3 feet and it's a 3-point shot in the corner. And like, I think the guy who really captures what changed in the NBA, as far as you can see his career and be like, oh, that was what the NBA was and what it turned into all in one career, is LaMarcus Aldridge. Mm. Because for the first half of his career, he was one of the best post scorers in the NBA. He could face you up. He could back you down. He had spin moves. He had the little like floater hook shot thing. He could hit a fadeaway shot on you. And then it got to the point where I think it was when he was with the Spurs, where they were like, we need you to back up 4 feet and turn those 18 footers into 22 foot corner threes. And he figured it out. He was pretty good at it. But he had to change his entire philosophy because everyone else in the league was like, that part of the floor is not valuable anymore because it's so close to the most valuable part of the floor, which is the corner three. So I think if you eliminate the corner three, you make that part of the floor valuable again. And especially because everyone's still going to want to shoot threes, so you're going to have all these players up towards the elbows, up above the break. And it's going to create more space in that low post area. You get those guys who can make a 15, 16 foot shot in their sleep. That's more valuable now.
Hey, and sometimes in general, y'all, and I said this on Twitter, and it's a football reference or a football video game reference. I like seeing basketball games on all Madden. I don't know. I like, sometimes a struggle is good. Everything doesn't have to be easy and pretty. Sometimes ugly basketball is good basketball. It doesn't have to always look one way. It doesn't always have to look pretty. If you're going to be a playoff team of consequence, you see it in the playoffs when teams can't hit shots. They don't have a backup plan. They don't look towards the other parts of real estate and say, okay, there's valuable real estate here that we can exploit. It is, man, we got to, not that they turn into robots, because players are players. They're going to go out and play. But you don't see someone like a guy like Jason Tatum, who has made a living out of taking the step back three, sometimes a little too much. At 6'9", he can't walk somebody down to that, to the low, not low box, but mid box. 17, 18 feet, turn around, shoot over the top of you. That's good real estate there. Exploit the real estate. So we've just fixed the league. We didn't, but you know, we fixed the world problems there. That's just one thing for me is handshaking. For John, it's eliminate the corner three, which I do like. There's also ways that you can make the lane the international lane. You know, you can call more on offensive players taking advantage of the rules, the flopping, the leaning in. Remember the Trae Young, the emphasis on the Trae Youngs and James Harden things a couple of years ago. Make sure you call carries now. Nobody calls carries anymore, all that stuff. So, but it is that time of the week, John, where we're going to pick a game that intrigues us, and we're going to explain why. John, you have two games. I have one. Go ahead and give me yours.
I have two games because one of these could really be bad. Nuggets at Thunder on Wednesday, I think is going to be fantastic. Those two teams, I've watched every game they've played against each other this year. The Thunder are definitely using the Nuggets as a measuring stick. Mm-hmm. And as every time they've met throughout the season, you can tell the Nuggets are taking them more and more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have reached a point in the season, and I could be wrong about this, but I've been paying attention to the Nuggets, and I feel like we've reached a point in the season where the Nuggets are absolutely tired of just not being in first. They're tired of hearing, I don't know, they don't really have any like statement wins this year. Like, right. They are tired of it. And so I think they're looking at that Thunder game as like, we are going to show up. We're going to try and embarrass this team that is still ahead of us in the standings. And we're going to try and show everyone that we are still the team to beat. So I'm looking forward to that. That one's going to be great. And then Lakers-Celtics on Thursday. Mm-hmm. Nuggets-Thunder is tonight, by the way. Lakers-Celtics on Thursday. I'm interested in because when the Lakers want to show up, it seems like they can. And it seems like they can play a level of almost playoff style basketball that is really hard to beat. It's how they won the in-season tournament. I get the feeling they're going to want to do that against the Celtics, which means we're going to get LeBron's best punch. We're going to get Anthony Davis's best punch, and we're going to see if the Celtics can take it. I don't know if Porzingis is going to play or not. He's kind of been in and out of the lineup, I think the Lakers are about to throw their best punch at the Celtics and see what happens.
That's interesting. One, LeBron tweeted last night, like sands of an hourglass, of course, because this is right around the time of year where right up until the trade deadline where LeBron has sent out these subliminals. He's got more subliminals than a Machiavelli 7 record. Y'all remember when Machiavelli used to come out? There used to be a Tupac record every year after he died. And it would say, Tupac is alive. Listen to the clues. That's LeBron at this stage. LeBron has turned into Tupac with his subliminal messages on Twitter, except we know LeBron is still alive. It's just his team is dead. And as far as the Nuggets Thunder, I do like, here's one note that I do like. I don't know if the Nuggets so much don't like not being in first as much as they realize the Clippers are coming. We have to stay ahead of them. I don't think they're worried about the Timberwolves. I know they're not worried about the Thunder in that way because they probably believe those teams don't have the experience to really challenge us in a playoff series. But they probably look at the Clippers and say, we probably want home court advantage against them. My game is also Thursday night, a TNT game, I believe. Pacers at Knicks. We talked about it a little bit earlier. We went heavy Knicks on Monday with Fred Katz. The Knicks are bludgeoning teams. They bludgeoned the Utah Jazz last night to the point that Mike Breen was going in on Colin Sexton before the bludgeoning began, all right? And, of course, you got Tyrese Halliburton, who is the number one engine driver of an offense in this league. The Pacers are scoring 124 points tonight when he plays, 30 assists tonight when he plays. He's probably not going to play the heavy, heavy minutes because he's probably on some level of minute restriction with the hamstring. But going into Madison Square Garden in those jerseys and Spike Lee on the sidelines, it's going to bring back some good old feelings. I wouldn't be surprised if Reggie Miller was on the call and they probably boo that man to this day, right? But the Knicks beat up teams. The Pacers play pretty. Styles make fights. Pascal Siakam is there. I'm very curious to see. And Tom Thibodeau plays his players 45 minutes a damn night like it's no tomorrow. All right, cool. Let's see how this works. I'm very curious to see how that game shakes itself out on Thursday night.
Yeah, I'll just say this. I watched a lot of Pacers-Celtics last night. And if Tyrese Halliburton had not been on a minutes restriction, I think that's a different game. I think that's a Pacers got at least 50-50 shot taking that one home. And these are two more teams in the top 4 or 5 of the East trying to prove against each other who's better. Both of them with, you know, recent acquisitions from the trade market. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be a really fun one.
Trade deadline's coming up. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what teams decide to do what based on this past or this coming week, the rest of this week and the trade deadline coming up in a little over a little over a week. It's February 7th. So it's going to be big days coming up. And I'm very curious to see how all these teams evaluate themselves in the immediate light of how they're playing, especially the Lakers with LeBron basically saying, Rob Pelinka, what are you doing? Darvin Ham, what are you doing? Jeannie Buss, what are you doing? You know, it's that time of year. It's that time of year for LeBron James and the Lakers. And they slipped under 500 with a loss to Atlanta. Although, John, I will say, as one, the schedule makers did not do them any favors. A Houston, Atlanta back-to-back? What are you trying to do to my nightlife? Right? I can't spend a night in Houston, and then I got to go in Atlanta and not be able to get my, you know, my chicken wings. All right, cool. Cool. I got something for y'all, NBA. All right, cool. But that is all we have for you today on The Good Word. Thanks again to producer John for helping out on the mic and all the work that everybody does behind the scenes. Jake and Dan will be back for another episode of No Cap Room tomorrow. You might hear Jake with me on Monday for another episode of The Good Word in preparation for the trade deadline. Until then, everybody be safe.